Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're talking to Jeff Chester. He is Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, D.C., and he's author of the book Digital Destiny, published by the New Press. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you so much.
You've been studying the media in this country and the emergence of cable and digital media for years, and I thought we could start by really looking back more toward the beginning of the 20th century. The history of media regulation and later deregulation all started in 1934. What was happening at that time? We were in the Great Depression that caused our elected officials to make laws regulating the new broadcast media of that time.
Well, actually, it was the commercial broadcasting industry at that time that asked the government to come in. Already by the late 1920s in the United States, powerful corporate interests such as Westinghouse and NBC, which was then owned by RCA and then CBS, already occupied major radio channels. These powerful interests did not want to see competition emerge. It did not want to see a channels reserved for non-commercial use, for community use. They had a business model back in the late 1920s that would ultimately ensure that most of the powerful broadcasting interests would be dominated by advertising. So they asked the government to step in and to so-called regulate the airwaves, so only a few people would, the vested interest would have control.
Was there also a technical component to it? In other words, if one sender was sending it, one broadcaster was sending it 90.7, there had to be just basic regulation so that another broadcaster wouldn't broadcast at the same frequency.
Well, you know, by the early 1920s, the federal government, once again, at the behest of the radio industry, moves in to control who can broadcast over what frequency. You're absolutely right. There was this kind of cacophony of the air where different radio interests might be using the same channel, or amateur so-called ham operators could be broadcasting on those frequencies. All that interference, a babble of the air, so to speak, led the leading industry companies to approach the federal government. The Republican administration at that time included Herbert Hoover, who later became president. Hoover was the Commerce Secretary, and under President Coolidge, and it was Hoover who helped create the plan that led really to the current system still in effect, where you apply to the federal government, you were given a license, and in return for allegedly serving the public interest, you're guaranteed access to a particular frequency, a place on the what was used to be called the radio dial that doesn't have any interference.
Now, the term public interest is a very important one. What did that mean?
The potential of radio to serve the public interest already by the late 1920s was threatened. When radio emerged in the late teens and the early 20s, it seized the imagination of the public, much as the internet has today. And indeed, there are some parallels. And people then predicted that the amazing potential and power of radio would literally, quote unquote, end all future wars. Educators, religious leaders, community officials all saw radio as a key democratic medium that would spur civic engagement and creative expression, and many of them occupied radio channels in the 1920s. But as the big business interests moved in and realized they could make a huge amount of money selling radio time to advertisers, and indeed the public was hungry to receive over this miraculous new technology, music and comedy and talk from both down the street and around the world, there was a market there. So by the early 1930s, the commercial radio industry had organized the lobby to make sure it could control the future of the radio medium, and it developed a political strategy to do so.
And there's a very much a parallel to what we're living through today with the internet, which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
I mean, I think, look, the key, sad moment occurred when a coalition of religious and labor and educators got together in the early 1930s and said, look, we don't like the way radio is going. We don't like the fact that these big companies are gobbling up all the channels, that they're eliminating the programs about public education and about civic life, and they're putting on, you know, music and selling advertising. We're going to get Congress to reserve 1/4 of all the frequencies for non-commercial public use. We want to kind of have a mini BBC in the United States. So there was a major political effort, and that battle was fought out during the debate over the 1934 Communications Act, the law still on the books today that in essence governs broadcast radio and television. Well, those public interest forces that wanted a piece of the airwaves to really be the public's were defeated. But in exchange, the commercial industry said, in what would be just an endless series of broken promises subsequently, don't worry, Congress, don't worry, public, we will operate in the public interest. We will be public interest trustees. Just give us these free channels to operate for a lifetime, and we'll be good.
I think the point that you're making and that you make in many different ways in your book is that what we see and hear in the broadcast media is very much determined by the regulatory environment in which the media exist, and not, as many claim, that the media just give people what they want.
Well, I think it is a kind of complicated question in light because of what is happening today with the online world. Look, the fact that only a few people can really speak. I mean, what we did back in the 1930s and what we've been able to do since then is really dislodge these very powerful interests. First it was CBS and NBC, and then it became, you know, ABC and Time Warner and Comcast and the others. All these very powerful media entities have been able to use the political process in Washington and oftentimes in state capitals and city halls as well. But principally in Washington, these interests have been able to use their power to get whatever policies they needed so they could, in fact, determine what America heard and saw. Dissenting views, alternative views, were either censored or pushed to the extreme margins, which ultimately is one reason why the public supported the creation of PBS and public radio many years ago. So it's indeed these policy decisions that have kept a very few in control, but ultimately the business model that they developed was something that policy had little to do with, in a sense, which is that what we get is determined by whether or not it can sell advertising and deliver eyeballs.
What happened, jumping forward from the 30s, what happened under Ronald Reagan? What were the media like in the 70s compared to the 80s and 90s?
Well, from the 1930s on to about the early 1980s, the Federal Communications Commission, which is the government agency responsible for overseeing the electronic media, went through various periods of activism. And during that time, it developed a number of rules designed to make local TV and radio stations more accountable to communities. Those stations, in order to get their license renewed, would actually have to document in writing how it served the public interest, what kind of news and information it put on. And a number of positive things occurred because of that regulatory system. The stations feeling pressure put on more news. They put on some investigative programming, some consumer programming. Certainly without the threat of losing their license, they wouldn't have hired women and people of color who finally, you know, make it into the station newsrooms and management ranks in the 60s and 70s. But by the time Reagan comes in 1981, he appoints a very pro-industry FCC chair. That person proceeds to get rid of most of the media ownership rules and policies requiring public service, so that by the end of the 1980s, you have a handful of television networks owning many more stations. Television and radio really no longer have to report back to the public about how they're serving them. You can get your license renewed still today by sending in a postcard to the FCC. And as a result of the change of ownership of the then three television networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC, those powerful entities begin reducing their budgets for news, closing overseas bureaus, and ultimately diminishing the amount and quality of news that the American public receives.
So there's two effects going on here. One is that the American public gets less news and gets less news that's relevant to understanding the world in which they live, and large companies make more money. Under the Reagan era, I mean, what was the Reagan administration's motivation in going that direction? Was there actually a political motivation in limiting the stories that Americans are hearing and the things they're knowing about?
I think there's always a political motivation on the part of these administrations when they adopt and embrace communications policy. But, you know, whether it was a kind of surface response or something well-calculated, the Reagan administration, much like the current Bush regime, simply didn't believe that any rules were necessary for the communications industry. The Reagan FCC looked at television and saw an so-called explosion of outlets. You then not only had broadcasting, you had the emergence of cable and the potential of satellite. They felt that the public interest was best served by whoever won in the so-called marketplace. So it was that kind of irresponsible, thoughtless analysis which led ultimately to the debacle that occurred during the Reagan administration to American television in particular.
I asked the question because of the Vietnam War, which was broadcast on television, and there's such a striking contrast between the way war was broadcast in the 70s and the way it's broadcast today. And so, you know, there is a sort of philosophical, ideological, you know, capitalist market force deregulation thing, but there's also, like, let's not show the people war.
No, it took a while back in the early 1970s to finally get U.S. broadcasting to critically tackle the then Vietnam War. You're absolutely right. I mean, people called it most famously the Living Room War. It was a well-known book at the time,
right?
Because night after night, you did see the carnage. Something that the current television system really covers up in many ways. And I do think that there's been this impact, as you suggested before, between consolidation, fewer owners in control of television, broadcasting and cable, and concerned about what the public can see that might ultimately threaten the system. I don't think. But by the 1980s, you no longer have the United States engaged in a kind of long term war like Vietnam. You have the various invasions such as Grenada, and you have the efforts against the government in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas. So by the late 1970s, it was the Carter administration that helped developed this notion of quote-unquote deregulation for communications. This was an ideology that had been developed and applied to trucking and airlines, where there was this, I think, fallacious notion that there was a diverse and competitive industry, and that ultimately was a model of how the public interest system could work by depending upon the market. They tried to take that idea that their so-called competition would provide the American public with in-depth information and diversity of expression, and when they applied it to broadcasting and communications. But of course, the media is not just another industry. And when you have only a handful of voices producing the information that most of Americans depend upon, and when you have those voices ultimately not willing to challenge, the status quo, that has terrible consequences for the public. So I don't believe at the time there was a kind of conspiracy to silence the media. We know that both President Johnson and President Nixon during the Vietnam War did in fact try behind the scenes to pressure how television portrayed them.
We're talking to Jeff Chester. He's the author of the book Digital Destiny, published by the New Press. I think another important point that you make is that the media fail consistently to report critically about themselves, particularly when they're owned by large corporate owners.
There's no question that the American public has been uninformed by the very interests that they depend upon to give them information about the world and national affairs. When it comes to what these very same news organizations are doing in Washington, I don't believe CNN, for example, or Fox News has ever told its viewers, oh, by the way, our parent companies are lobbying on how many TV stations a single company can own, whether or not the cable rates should be rolled back, whether or not the Internet should be returned to its former regulatory status as an open highway. These big media companies simply never, including the New York Times, never tell the public about what they or their corporate parents are doing when it comes to pushing special interest legislation in Washington.
Is there any significant difference between the Democratic and Republican parties in terms of the whole issue of how media is regulated and deregulation and so on? And talk about the 1996 Telecommunications Act under Clinton in those terms.
Sadly, I think, and for the most part, both parties, the major parties, Republican and Democrat, are under the influence of these powerful lobbies. And one of the dangers you have now is as these big interests converge along with this so-called convergence of media, of old and new media, you're seeing, a kind of super a lobby alliance appear where you're bringing together interests representing really the most powerful forces on the planet, Hollywood and Silicon Valley and Wall Street and the communications and telecommunications industries. They regularly hire not just the top staff at the FCC, but commissioners. The two most recent chairs of the FCC, one Republican, one a Democrat, left office and immediately went to work for media investment firms, helping them buy up the very media companies that only a short while ago they were so-called regulating, overseeing. So tremendous amounts of money come in, and that's why, for the most part, both parties, sadly, when it comes to media and telecommunications issues, are more or less following the same page. It's the market and big money that ultimately they're willing to allow to control the U.S. communication system.
There's a real irony there that you point out, and that is that the forces behind media consolidation argue that they're creating competition even as they create virtual monopolies. Can you dissect that argument?
Yes, I mean it's a great example of the Orwellian doublespeak. And this is part of what I call the repetitive promises syndrome, going back to what their predecessors claimed in the 1930s. Don't worry, we'll serve the public interest. They will get up in front of Congress or at the FCC and say, just get rid of the rules designed. Believe it or not, they'll say this: just get rid of the rules designed to promote diversity of ownership, and we promise you that we'll see more competition, more opportunities for expression, more women and people of color hired. They keep arguing that by getting rid of the rules and safeguards designed to ensure we actually have some more diversity of ownership and the free flow of information, that we will get more. But of course, they're simply lying. I mean, what these big companies are aiming to do always is to remove any impediment facing them that prevents them from controlling as many radio, TV stations, cable systems, newspapers, and now internet outlets as they would like.
You've pointed out the dangers of this on a civic level. There's also actual health dangers, as I've heard the story in your book and on Democracy Now! About the small town in North Dakota that had a chemical spill, and all the radio stations were vacant because they were owned by Clear Channel, and nobody was there.
I think media consolidation is a threat, not only to our democratic existence, but also certainly to our physical and mental and public health. Look, today, if there was an emergency in many towns, you wouldn't know it from turning on the television or even on the radio. These huge operations are owned by companies, not in your hometown, but often thousands of miles away. In the case of radio, much of the programming literally comes out of a basement in New Jersey when it comes to the giant Clear Channel operation. So there's been a reduction in local news staffs, a reduction overall in the ability of news media to support meaningful reporting. And I think the best example, and where the media industry lobbying, I think, came in, was the failure of the media industry, the news industry, to challenge the Bush administration's, what we know were false assumptions about weapons of mass destruction controlled by Saddam Hussein. Hardly anyone in the news industry stood up to the Bush administration. I think it's worth noting, though, that at the very same time, you had an overall kind of endorsement by broadcast cable television and many newspapers of the Bush plan to invade Iraq, these very same outlets were lobbying the Bush administration to win very important concessions for them at the FCC.
There's another failure you point out. I mean, I think probably many of our listeners have talked about the mainstream media endorsement of the invasion of Iraq and the failure to do any real digging on that. But another thing you point out in your book, which I hadn't really thought about as much, was that even while the news media congratulated themselves on their non-commercial coverage of 9/11, they had virtually no coverage of the threat to the United States by al-Qaeda or any group of that ilk before 9/11.
I think that deregulation and consolidation that we saw back in the 1980s, that continued in the 90s and is occurring now, has ultimately become a real threat to our national security, so to speak, because the American public simply isn't receiving from this news system the kind of information they need to better understand what's going on in the world. And, ever since the television networks back in the 1980s, as a result of so-called deregulation, closed their overseas bureaus because they didn't want to spend the money anymore, there's been a real reduction in the amount of information Americans are receiving about what others in the world really think about us. So you have a very kind of narrow ideological, framework, for lack of a better word, governing much of what we get from television news. And you have a newspaper industry that, with rare exceptions, doesn't put the resources in to give the public serious in-depth information about what's going on from abroad. So indeed, I hold the news media responsible for not alerting the American public in a significant way that there was a growing anger towards the United States that had developed as a result of our political position with Israel and Palestine, as well as our support of dictatorships throughout the Middle East.
Now, the phrase "follow the money" could be the subtitle of almost any chapter in your book. But some of the big media money is hidden in apparently non-commercial groups, such as think tanks, supposed public interest groups, academic forums. How does this work? Tell us about that whole world.
Well, like any issue, you know, the environment and healthcare, you know, the special corporate interests have unlimited amounts of money and have developed ingenious, you know, political campaigns to secure whatever their goals are, and to, in particular, undermine the work of groups such as mine and Consumers Union and Free Press and other so-called reform organizations. So the big media companies, whether it's Time Warner or AT&T or Comcast, first, of course, they won't write generous checks out to key groups. So, for example, you'll see Comcast has been funding the Congressional Black Caucus for a number of years. Time Warner has given money to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights for a number of years. These big companies create what I call front groups, organizations that have nice-sounding names like Consumer Alliance that allegedly represent the interests of the average person, but in fact whose agenda dovetails precisely with their corporate sponsors. You have corporate foundations writing big checks to critical public interest groups, in essence immobilizing their ability to act on an issue that would be of importance to their constituents, because those groups are fearful of losing funding in these always budgetary tight times. So, you know, when you ask yourself, why hasn't there been any progress to open up the airwaves and cable, et cetera, in terms of the public interest advocacy, you have to ask yourself, well, what else has the big media industry been doing? And they've been, you know, buying up academics and universities and groups left and right now for the last 10, 15 years.
Tell us about Michael Powell's recent tenure as FCC chairman under George W. Bush.
Well, Michael Powell, I mean, I always say we should be grateful to the former Republican chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael K. Powell, who's the son of the former Secretary of State and General Colin Powell, because Mr. Powell was so cocksure of himself during his tenure as a chair that he literally alienated practically everyone from left to right and helped encourage what has been the most successful sort of public interest revolt against the media industry in decades. So for that, we'll always be grateful to him. But Powell came in much like his predecessor during the Reagan era, with this kind of, you know, rose-colored glasses on. I mean, it's one thing to sort of say, well, I think there's a lot of diversity and competition today, and I'm going to do some independent research, and let's have a debate about it. But Michael Powell is the kind of person who came into the FCC and said, I know it all. There's tremendous diversity. There's tremendous competition. The Internet is coming. I'm going to get rid of all of the remaining rules at the FCC designed to promote media diversity. And that's what he tried to do. He had to be stopped. And as a consequence, there was a very significant opposition that emerged to fight him, that was ultimately successful in stalling what Powell was pursuing. But literally under Powell's proposal, which is still what's being debated today by his predecessor, his successor, the FCC under Powell approved a plan so that one single company in one large town could control three television stations, eight radio stations, the major daily newspaper, the cable system, and that community's key internet service provider. One company control of all that power in a single town, and also under Powell's plan, that same company could own so much in terms of media outlets across the country. Fewer and fewer owners of most of the media outlets. And, Powell predicated, what was ironic and tragic, was that Powell predicated much of his proposals to end media ownership rules on the emergence of the Internet. But it was under Michael Powell that the Bush FCC approved what has become known as a radical effort to give control over the future of the Internet here to the cable and telephone industry, so the ending of so-called network neutrality.
Which I want to talk more about in a minute. But what was the nature of the uprising against these policies of Michael Powell? It was a coalition of a lot of diverse groups.
Well, you know, Powell, I said, was kind of the perfect villain in a way. I mean, tragically so, because here he was proposing, you know, I said the most radical elimination of media ownership safeguards in decades, and was doing it without a serious public debate, without any independent investigation and research, without reaching out to journalists and Hollywood producers and others to find out what was really going on inside various parts of the media business. He had an ideological framework, and because the chair really runs that agency, even though there were four other commissioners, a total of five, the FCC is really managed by whoever is the chair. He was forcing the agency to come up with this plan, and I think that, frankly, people opposed to the Iraq invasion played a very key role in fomenting what eventually became a very powerful bipartisan backlash against Powell, because once the invasion of Iraq was over, and members of the peace community found out that most of the news media that had not been critical of the Bush plan for the invasion was also lobbying the Bush FCC for these big media ownership giveaways, they became quite angry, and that eventually ignited a kind of grassroots bipartisan effort, where organizations on the right, Parents Television Council being a good example, joined with organizations on the so-called left, such as Move On and mainstreamers like Common Cause, to create a very huge public coalition opposed to the Powell plan to eliminate the media rules. Eventually, members of both parties weighed in. They themselves worried about the new rules that would allow one company to become a kind of local Citizen Kane, control so much media power in that town that you had senators and congresspeople from both parties joining the goals of that coalition. Finally, through the work of public interest lawyers, a federal court overturned most of what Powell had successfully gotten past the FCC. And today, the rules that Powell was able to get through have been stayed since 2003, and are now the subject of a current proceeding at the FCC.
We're talking to Jeff Chester, author of Digital Destiny. Let's talk about the Internet. Who invented it, and for what purpose was originally intended?
Well, the Internet evolved as a medium that was principally used by government researchers and then other university researchers. Part of the Internet grew up as a result of the government's interest in having a kind of quote-unquote fail-safe communications network that would operate in times of nuclear attack. Part of the roots of the Internet go back to the Defense Department. But by the early 1990s, there were enough people using the online medium that it was spun off from its government roots and allowed to grow commercial. And I think since 1993, 1994, the basic framework for the Internet as principally a kind of public commercial medium has been firmly set.
And so when did big media and cable and phone companies get interested in controlling the net? What do they want?
Well, the big companies, the telecommunication companies, and I think most importantly, the advertisers, largest advertisers, understood early on, by the early 1990s, 1994 is when you have the first real ad online, shortly after the Internet has sort of gone public. They understood that the Internet would evolve as an important new medium of communication, and that the Internet itself was going to be perhaps the perfect medium for the both the delivery of entertainment, but also for advertising. Because instead of the kind of mass nature of television and radio, where you know many of us listen to one program, the Internet allowed a kind of precise delivery of individual programs and services, including advertising. The big phone and cable companies, however, grow very alarmed by the end of the 1990s because they see that if the Internet is allowed to continue to evolve, eventually it's going to be transformed into what we now call broadband, this higher speed service compared to the way we used to get the Internet, where most of us used to get the Internet through phone lines, but that broadband, which fundamentally threatened the business future of cable and phone, because an open, high-speed Internet would permit the delivery of unlimited amounts of video programming, hence a threat to the cable company's business interests, and also a high-speed Internet would permit anyone to send and receive a phone call literally for pennies, obviously a threat to the telephone companies.
And so what did they do, and where does this whole debate stand now?
Well, from the late 1990s, advocates such as myself, Media Access Project, Consumers Union, and others began pressing the then Clinton FCC to adopt a safeguard, saying that as the Internet evolves into this high-speed medium, the same policies that have shaped the Internet in the United States, requiring an open system and an open highway, an open pipeline. It's called non-discrimination because the Internet here in the United States, you know, evolved first as a medium being transported over telephone lines. It benefited significantly from the federal regulations governing the telephone, which required the phone companies to operate their networks, their lines, as quote-unquote common carriers, but in essence ensuring an open pathway. And that open pathway proved instrumental for the success of the Internet in the 1990s because there were no gatekeepers. Anybody could create a website and was assured that anybody could have access to that website in a fair way. And that's why a Google or a Yahoo or an Amazon.com could create a service, you know, out of a garage one night, you know, and soon find themselves, if they were lucky, reaping huge fortunes because of the open nature of the Internet as required by FCC regulation. Well, the phone and cable companies didn't like that FCC regulation. They didn't want to see broadband be that kind of open Internet, and they began a campaign in the late 90s, which culminated successfully for them at the Bush FCC over the last few years, where they have eliminated that safeguard requiring an open highway when it comes to broadband here in the United States. So technically now, we have a high-speed Internet in the United States, which now, by the way, serves the majority of Internet households. More people subscribe to so-called broadband than they do a dial-up. And the phone and cable companies now provide, and I think this is a kind of astounding, shocking statistic, the phone and cable companies control 98% of connections for broadband to consumers here. But when you receive your Internet from phone and cable companies, they're under no obligation to treat all content in a fair way. They can, and they've expressed an interest in doing so, to create fast lanes where the content that comes with the biggest bucks behind it will get to your PC screens and your TVs and your mobile phones faster than, let's say, the public interest community content. Some content could be slowed down if it competes with phone and cable company-owned or favored content. And that's why there is growing bipartisan movement to restore what's called neutrality, network neutrality, back to the Internet. And now there are bills in Congress that would reverse what the FCC did, but it's unlikely those bills will pass in the short term.
You have an amazing chapter on data collection on individuals through the Internet. And it's funny because years ago, before even the Internet, my friend Sean was talking about how they should make a magazine called Sean, which contains articles and ads about all of his interests, since marketers are already collecting all that information.
It's coming next week. Tell Sean to get ready for it.
Well, this is it's practically now a reality. I mean, tell us about this whole data collection thing.
I think that for me, one of the most alarming aspects of the transformation to our digital system, and there's no question, we're going to be living in a digitally connected universe. We will, in a short amount of time, a majority of us, always be connected to the Internet wherever we go. The Internet will be literally flowing through the PCs. Television's about to go digital interactive. Cell phones, mobile devices will be Internet connected. This is the world that's being created for us as a result of technology and also a corporate investment. But behind all of it is the money and interest to make the new media a much more effective vehicle for advertising and for marketing, especially coming from the wealthiest companies, the biggest brands, so to speak. You know, think car companies, fast food companies, for example. And a system has been put in place to help deliver these interactive ads, and in part it's based on a ingenious scheme of data collection where today, as we are online on a regular basis, as we go to many of the major sites, they're collecting information about not just what site we visit, but our various behaviors on that site, where our mouse is on a particular page, whether or not we watch a video, where we stop it. They take that data about us. They place a file in our computer that provides them access to information about us. As we go site to site, different websites contribute little bits and pieces of information about our so-called behaviors. Also, we can be targeted with advertising. And new technologies are emerging based on so-called virtual reality that are designed to purposely reach into our unconscious minds. I know I'm beginning to sound kind of both Orwellian or perhaps psychotic, but this is what, perhaps I wish it was true, but this is what the interactive advertising industry is really working on to create the most powerful system to promote marketing and consumption ever developed by humans.
I mean, the potential for invasion of privacy seems huge in addition to just simply wasting massive amounts of the citizenry's time and money.
Well, it has huge privacy implications. These marketers claim that they don't know your name, they may not know your address, so they can easily obtain it. But the fact of the matter is that they know your behaviors, and they know the behaviors of your kids. They know your online behaviors, what kind of content you like, what you do online, what you buy, what you may not want to buy, what your favorite music is, what your favorite colors are. They have tremendous amounts of information about you, and they're going to be merging this information with offline databases. And as we increasingly become a much more mobile-dependent society, as we begin Internet more, via our cell phones, for example, they intend to track us as well, and to pool that information. So this is, and of course, all this information could be and has in fact been turned over to the government, and recently, in several cases. So we our privacy is truly threatened by the emergence of these powerful forces of digital media. And sadly, Congress has still not, because of industry opposition, passed any protections that would allow us to control information about ourselves.
Tell us about the Center for Digital Democracy, of which you are the executive director.
It's a watchdog group, and I won't bark as I say that. Look, all of these powerful interests, need to be watched. I suppose corporate interests would say, and of course they do have people watching public interest groups, but the media and telecommunications play a very critical role in helping define our reality and helping define our consciousness in being the industry that is up until now been set up to provide the public with information about what's going on in our town and our country and around the world. And in my opinion, the news media and the media industries have done a horrible job in really providing us with a system that would better serve the country as a democracy. So they need to be watched. They need to be exposed. They need to be challenged. They need to be ashamed. And that's what we at the Center for Digital Democracy do. My colleagues and other organizations such as Consumers Union and Free Press do the same. We're voices of conscience. We're industry watchdogs. But at the Center for Digital Democracy, we're looking at new media in particular. We're looking at the cable and telephone company plans for the future, what the advertising industry is doing. We're making some of that information available on our website also working on plans to sort of, organize against them so that we have at least a portion of the media system that serves the interests of the country versus narrow economic returns for shareholders, which is the primary motivation of most of these big companies.
It's daunting. I mean, when you look at the 1934 Telecommunications Act, when you look at the FCC deregulation under Ronald Reagan, when you look at even the movie Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow and the domination of commercial interests of his reporting, when you look at the Michael Powell administration, I mean, you've got an uphill battle because this goes on generation after generation.
Well, but I think we're at a very critical point, and we have to make a kind of strategic decision. And it's not all bad news, because the emergence of the internet and broadband, is now kind of accompanied by a whole different way that people potentially access information. And in the old days, you would say, as you said before, you'd follow the money. But I'm saying now there's another M word. It's called follow mobile. What I mean is that younger people, kids and teens and college age students, have grown up, used to having a digital media system always, most of them, always accessible, certainly if they can afford it, and to be able to access whatever they want. And the media system, as a result, is going through an important transition. The public interest community, people concerned about community media, need to sort of, seize the initiative here and stake out significant places within this new media culture where the public interest, is our business model, even if, groups engage in kind of commercial efforts to help pay for it. In other words, while we still have to fight them in Washington, there's a critical moment here to seize the initiative and carve out a portion of the system that can serve the interests that we most care about. I think that's possible now, but if we don't, it's certainly going to be a highly commercialized and consolidated a digital system.
If our listeners want to get involved, what are some ways that they can really do something?
Well, I hope all your listeners will support the movement to restore non-discrimination, to return openness to the internet here in the United States. Best way to do that is
specifically net neutrality.
That's network neutrality. As I say, it's a bipartisan issue from the Christian Coalition to the Gun Owners of America to MoveOn.org. These groups and more are pressing Congress right now to restore network neutrality to the U.S. broadband internet. And the best way to do that is to join the Save the Internet, one word, .com organization. They can come to our website at democraticmedia.org, and they will learn what this Web 2.0, this next generation of the internet, it looks like, and what both the threats and opportunities are to promote the public interest. And finally, it's very important to make sure that there's a healthy community media system in every town as these digital platforms rapidly emerge. So groups need to support what their community public radio communities are doing.
Jeff Chester, thank you so much for spending all this time with us here on KSFR.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking to Jeff Chester. He's the author of the book Digital Destiny, published by the New Press. He's executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, D.C. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and we are podcasting. You can find us at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.